delighted to introduce Michael Lynch from the University of Connecticut, who's going to be speaking to us on expressivism and plural truth. Welcome, Michael.
So if indeed the human serpent has its trail over all, then as Simon reminded us, many of us can't help but think that its coils are wound more tightly around some aspects of our conceptual geography. Indeed, this may, of course, just show us that we've thrown our lot in with philosophers, those who make the puzzling familiar and the familiar puzzling. An example, perhaps, of both of these is this inconsistent triad of judgments that we are attracted to, I believe, in our life, a triad that will be, I'm no doubt, be discussed much over the next couple days, and then Simon has already indicated. On the one hand, we tend to think that value judgments, like the judgment that murder is wrong, are true. We assert them. We assert them often with great confidence, often, in fact, with greater confidence than we assert most of the other judgments we make in life. We're willing to back them up with reasons. We infer from them, and so forth. They bear all the marks of truth, and we tend to think that they are true. But it also seems to us, at least some of us, that value judgments don't represent reality. There seems to be nothing in the world to which these value judgments correspond, at least not in the natural world. And for many of us, as Simon also suggested, the natural world is, in some sense, all the world there is. And finally, many of us, or many, perhaps not many of us in this room, but many philosophers in general, have traditionally been attracted to the idea that all true judgments represent reality. And so the inconsistency. Some value judgments are true. No value judgments represent reality. But all true judgments represent reality. How to make sense of all these? And of course, we have the familiar options. The realist rejects two. They insist that some value judgments are, in fact, some value judgments do represent reality, and so are perfectly good standing for being true, according to three. And error theorists reject one. They maintain that it's true that all judgments, true judgments, represent reality, and they think that no value judgment does so, but they conclude, therefore, that some value judgments are not, that no value judgment is true. Both of these philosophers, the realist and the error theorist, are impressed by what I'll call the unity of judgment, by the idea that judgments of all kinds are subject to the same kind of rational appraisal, in this case, truth. Of course, our main character for today's story, the expressivist, has always tried a different tack. The expressivist, as I like to think of it, tends to think that the fact that valuers are apt to miss their representational mark is not so much evidence that they have poor aim, but that they're shooting at something else entirely. And what that something else is requires a story. So the expressivist, in broad strokes, agrees with the error theorist that there are no values cluttering the natural landscape of the world, and traditionally denies one as well. Traditionally, the target judgments are neither true nor false. That's the traditional expressivist of yore. Hard to find those about nowadays. The expressivist of any type tends to oppose the picture that language or thought is a seamless web, as Simon once wrote. That is, the soothing away of distinctions, whether the primary versus secondary, fact versus value, description versus expression. They oppose the picture of language and thought as a seamless web. And therefore, the expressivist, I want to emphasize, privileges what I'll call the diversity of judgment, the intuition that different kinds of judgments serve different kinds of function. This was what Simon was emphasizing. Now, the traditional expressivist, as is well known, sacrifices the unity of judgment, gives up on the idea that there's one kind of rational appraisal by which we can evaluate, that is truth, that which we can evaluate expressive and non-expressive judgments, sacrifices that so in order to emphasize and privilege diversity. And of course, they pay the consequence for that. Here lurks the Frege Geech. Now, the Frege Geech problem, as I won't go over it in any good detail, it'll come back later on, is the idea of how to understand the fact that if judgments aren't, expressive judgments are neither true nor false, how do we use them in our reasoning? How do we embed them in conditionals and the antecedents of conditionals, and so forth and so on? Now, the quasi-realist is someone who thinks that the Frege Geech problem is, well, it's really just a little boy in a mask. It can be unmasked. It's not so scary after all. We can keep one and two, but deny three. We can say that all true judgments represent. So this is what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about two strategies that of taking this last hack. This tack of denying three and keeping one and two in my original inconsistent triad. The tack is something like this. We want to say that expressivism, the first tack rather, is something like this. Expressivism plus semantic minimalism. We're going to explore that. The second tack is expressivism and plural truth. I'll explain what I mean by these. My thesis will be that neither of these strategies actually works. But a third strategy that self-consciously draws on both their resources does. And this is the strategy that I'm going to recommend to the expressivist. Now, the pure or high church deflationist or minimalist, as I'm going to call them, so now what I'm going to do is move into this first section. I'm going to talk about the idea that we can combine deflationism with expressivism and get this notion that there can be expressive judgments that are true and therefore capture unity and diversity. So first we need to think about what deflationism or minimalism is. Again, this is all familiar. The idea that I'm going to talk about is that the concept of truth is a logical device. That's a central idea for the deflationist. That it functions as a device for generalization, and its role, therefore, is expressive and not explanatory. All right? That's what I mean as high church to deflationism or minimalism. Now, talking the realist, the quasi-realist wants to say that what we're going to do is we're going to take pure minimalism, deflationism, and combine it with expressivism. And by doing that, we're going to be able to talk the realist walk without walking the realist walk. We're going to be able to say things are true and yet not have to talk about representing any objects in reality. Because of the fact that it's easy to be truth apt, according to the pure minimalist, value judgments are truth apt, and a value judgment is true, to say that a value judgment is true, is to, in a sense, express our sentiments by other means. This has led to what we might call the instability objection, and this is something I want to pause now and talk quite a bit about. And this is the idea that this type of quasi-realism, this sort of combination of expressivism with minimalism, is open to a charge of instability. And this is a familiar charge. The idea is that expressivism requires a contrast between representational and expressive judgments. Pure minimalism doesn't allow us the resources to draw that distinction. And therefore, quasi-realism is unstable. More generally, quasi-realism undermines its own commitment to the diversity of judgment. That's the basic objection. The basic thought is, look, if it's so easy for expressive judgments to be true or false, if to be true or false is just what the deflationist or pure minimalist thinks that it is, then how are we going to draw the difference that we started out with? How are we going to capture the original idea that so motivated the view? The idea of diversity. So how are we going to do that? Well, by now, there are a number of different moves that are familiar to us that we can avail ourselves to respond to this instability objection. That is, if we're expressivist. Lots of different moves. I want to slow down, though, and think about a couple of these moves and see why these particular moves aren't happy ways of responding. Because I think we're going to learn something by this. I'm going to slow down a little bit and now think about this objection in general. Okay, so what's the sort of response that the expressivist, what sort of a response do we want from the expressivist? What we want is a way of capturing the differences between expressive and non-expressive judgment that is not in terms of truth, that allows us to be deflationist or minimalist, but still captures the differences. That's what this sort of expressivist or quasi-realist wants to do. How do we draw this bifurcation, as Rorty called it, and you likes to refer to it? Well, one thought would be to draw it in terms of belief. You might say that expressive judgments don't express beliefs, but descriptive ones do. Now, you probably already see that this would be a silly thing to say if you're a semantic minimalist, but I want to think about why that would be. It would be to say that we are minimalists about truth. Well, I've already said that, you know, I'm entertaining the idea that we're minimalist about propositional truth. And so on this view, murder is wrong is going to be true. And I can sincerely judge that it is, presumably. But if we're claiming that expressive judgments don't express beliefs, then it would follow that I couldn't believe that. And that would be very bizarre indeed. It would be the idea that there is no moral truth that I could believe. Moral judgments are true, but they don't express beliefs. Moral propositions are true, but I can't believe them. Bizarre. So if we deflate truth, then we'll deflate belief. And this is something that, of course, Simon and others have been very willing to do. Well, at least we'll deflate it in this sense. Being in a belief state doesn't entail being in a representational state. There might be all sorts of other interesting things to say about what beliefs are, but they're not going to be representations. Well, could we go another way? Could we say that we're minimalist about truth and now belief, but we can recapture the difference between expressive and non-expressive judgments by way of representation? Perhaps we can, in fact, think it's more natural to do that. To do so would be to claim that some judgments and beliefs are true but don't represent natural reality, and some are true and do represent. But what would that mean? What does that come to? What does that amount to? Well, I think it amounts to saying that the following does not hold all the way across the board. Call it represent. The view, roughly, that the belief that P is true because it represents that P and P. This is a very, very flat-footed notion of representation. Doesn't even say anything about what it is. But it does say one thing. It says that, look, what this seems to be, in other words, the idea I'm entertaining right now is the idea that we just deny that this holds across the board. We deny that in every domain. It's true that it is the case that beliefs are true because they represent whatever representation ends up being. Okay. Now we're getting somewhere. Now we might start thinking, okay, good. We've got our minimalism about truth. We've got our expressivism. Now we've got our contrast. And what does the contrast amount to? It just amounts to denying that this principle holds all the way across the board. What could be simpler? Job done. As Patrick likes to say, we're high and dry. But we might think that there's a problem now. Because where represent holds, belief truth is not a mere logical device. There's a problem, because remember, we're supposed to be minimalist. But I'm going to argue right now that can't be, there's a tension here. Because where represent does hold, remember we're saying that it doesn't hold across the board, but sometimes it holds. We presumably don't want to say P because the belief that P represents a P and P. If truth was just a logical device, we should be able to substitute right, the belief that P is true, we should be able to substitute P, right? If we're minimalist about propositional truth and now belief truth, which presumably we're going to be if we're minimalist about belief and minimalist about propositional truth, then we should be able to substitute. But that seems wrong. In fact, the person who thinks that represent holds in some particular domain is going to be very concerned to deny that in those domains, snow is white. Snow is white. Let me put it in that sort of way. Because what's on the right holds. That seems the wrong result. So if truth is sometimes more than an expressive device, belief truth, then belief truth isn't minimal. So it seems that we started out with this idea that we could somehow draw the contrast, be minimalist, and draw the contrast in terms of representation. It seems that that's not going to work. Because to do so drags us back into a non-minimalist notion of truth. So if one is a truth minimalist and a belief minimalist, one should be also a minimalist about representation. What would be a minimalist about representation? Well, I don't really know, but here's a stab. The belief that P is true, if and only if the belief that P represents that P and P. You just make it a coextensiveness claim. Then you can substitute. There's no dependency, no grounding, as Kit Fine likes to say, claim being made. So once we've deflated truth, belief and representation, value judgments, it seems, are going to be exceedingly difficult to distinguish from other kinds of judgments. It seems that the instability worry is coming back. We've now deflated truth, belief, and representation. Minimalism has a way of becoming, as Crispin has said, imperialistic. It creeps, as Jamie Dreyer says. And while that's a common intuition, what I've hoped to just shown is that there are some reasons to think that that's the case, some arguments to think that indeed that's what's going to happen. Once we let the minimalist camel nose underneath the tent, it walks off with everything. And instability returns. We get these value judgments are true, they express beliefs, they represent, perhaps they're about reality. What do? Maybe we go global. Maybe we just accept this. This is another suggestion. We might accept that, indeed. We really can't draw the distinction in the way that we thought. And that's okay. Maybe that's a happy consequence. This might be the idea that Price and MacArthur, and Price in more recent publications, has been floating, the global non-representationalism. No judgments represent in the sense of represent that I put up on the screen earlier. And we sew the seams of language with non-representational thread. That's the idea. We try to appeal to something completely different than these usual terms of belief and representation and so forth. So the seams that we started out being so concerned to highlight. Well, I have two worries about this. And I put them as worries because I'm not sure that they're arguments. But two worries. The first worry is, I still worry that, as obvious as, in fact, you as I think sensitive to this, that we give up the motivating expressivist insight. And this is how I put this here, that value judgments have a different role than other kinds of judgments, partly because they don't represent anything in the natural world. That is part of their distinctive character. Why is this an important point? Well, because, look, think about where we are. The global representationalist, anti-representationalist, tells us that, look, we can concede that that judgments don't represent across the board, no judgment represents in anything other than a minimalist way. And that's okay, because we can explain their function in other terms. But whatever, however compelling that function, that explanation might be, it seems to leave out something that got us started on this journey in the first place. Namely, that the fact that expressive judgments don't respond to things out in the natural world is part of what makes them, well, expressive. What makes us want to give them the character, the story that we are so concerned now to give. It's a simple point, but it bears repeating, I think. The second worry is one that Simon himself emphasized, and I won't spend much time on. It's the idea that some of our mental states just do seem responsive to objects in the world. And it seems plausible that explaining their content will involve appeals to this responsiveness. That one of the differences between explaining the content of our thoughts about tables and chairs and explaining the contents of our moral judgments is that it seems we have to appeal, Simon said, to tables and chairs in order to explain the content of the former. That is, to explain what they're about, the ordinary objects. And the point that I want to emphasize on this, a little bit different than Simon perhaps, is that where this responsiveness does seem plausible, it seems to me that contemporary cognitive science takes it to be at least a partly an empirical question whether a representational theory of content is apt. Cognitive scientists who worry about how we get into or the mental states we're in and those how those states are oriented towards the physical objects in our ordinary life, because that's what they're mostly interested in, take it presumably to be partly an empirical question whether truth conditional, let's say, semantics program is going to work. Maybe it's not going to work. But it seems as if we don't want to foreclose the possibility of it working. We don't want to have to go over to the linguistics and the psychology departments, down to the Haskins lab at Yale, where some of my friends work, and say, well, guys, you're going to have to close up shop on that project of understanding what representation is and thinking that that contributes to our understanding what our thoughts are about. Seems we want to leave that open. So that brings me to the second part of my talk. I now want to switch gears and think about, okay, if minimalism isn't going to pay off, if minimalism isn't going to pay off as a companion to expressivism, if what we've learned is, and this is what I think we've learned so far, that minimalism and expressivism undermine or make the view unstable, makes us lose diversity, then perhaps we can appeal to a different sort of possibility. So here's this cheery fellow. And he says, Simon says, the problem is, this is in 1984, the problem is not with the book he wrote in 1984, not in 1984. The problem is not with a subjective source of value in itself, but with people's inability to come to terms with it and their consequent need for a picture in which values imprint themselves on a pure, passive, receptive witness. This is great stuff. To show that those fears have no intellectual foundation or justification means developing a concept of moral truth out of the materials at hand, to seeing how, given attitudes, given constraints upon them, given a notion of improvement, we can construct a notion of moral truth. Notice the two things I've highlighted. First, that there's a subjective source of value. The early Blackburn is emphasizing what, in fact, he emphasized as well today, that we come at ethics with the thought there's something different, there's something subjective. The coils of the human serpent wind very tightly around the ethical judgment. And thereby, we need to construct a notion of truth in order to make sense of ourselves to ourselves. That's the idea I want to explore now. What would that idea amount to? Well, the simplest, straightforward way of understanding it would be to think that what he's on about here is that there are literally two different concepts of truth in operation. I mean, if you just read the 1984 book and you look at that, that's one of the things that sort of impresses you, is that he's thinking just in those terms of what we might call now simple truth pluralism. The idea is that there's one concept of truth that we have when we engage in moral discourse, and another concept of truth that we engage at when we engage in discourse about the everyday objects that clutter our lives. Now, what out of what materials are we going to construct a notion of moral truth? Well, the natural thought, and the one that in fact Simon appeals to in that book, is that we look to the norms of warrant that govern moral discourse. We look at what warrants our moves in the ethical conversational game. And one thought that about common thought about what warrants our moral judgments is that they display some sort of coherence, that they figure in some sort of, they end up being in some sort of reflective equilibrium. When they're in good standing, they move towards that reflective equilibrium, towards coherence. And when they're in bad standing, they move away from that state. So the thought, and I'm not going to go into great detail, the thought was, let's supersize, in a sense, that notion of warrant, that notion of coherence for moral judgments. If we can supersize it enough, then we'll take it seriously as a theory of, or as a concept, so to speak, of moral truth. That's the idea. Call that notion supercoherence. No, there's lots of things to say about it, but I'm not going to say it here. On this view, non-expressive judgments are true in one way. Expressive judgments are true in another way. And here, I also mention Crispin's view. The charm of the view is that unity is gained, but we have diversity too. The thought is that we have, like the deflationist thinks, that judgments are true, expressive judgments are true, but they're not true in the same way. Why aren't they true in the same way? Because we're talking about a different property of our moral judgments when we use the word true or ascribe the word true to them than when we ascribe the word true to our, or the concept of truth, to our non-moral judgments. So we have diversity. It sounds good. Another variation of this might be Yu's idea, or a way of interpreting your idea. Would be to say that, well, expressive judgments represent in one way, non-expressive judgments represent in another way. And this is going to be understood as being closer to Simon's original suggestion, just when, as you were suggesting, I think, yesterday, that this two notions of representation bring in their wake two different notions of truth. At least one could interpret you as thinking that. So, let me rain on this happy parade. I don't think that this is going to work as stands. There's something right about it, just like there's something right about the deflationist. But there are problems, too, and some of you have already heard me talk about this before on many different occasions. The first problem, so again, where are we? So the thought is, expressive judgments literally are true in a different sense than non-expressive judgments. That's the sort of simple version of the view that I'm now entertaining. How's it going to deal with problems like this? We have arguments of this sort. They seem valid, imprisoning people without charge is wrong. We imprisoned this person without charge. What we did to this person was wrong. Now, validity is truth preservation. Of course, I know that's a big if. But if it is, or even if we want it to be, in our logical dreams, it is mysterious how this argument could be valid. If simple truth pluralism is correct, the argument fails to preserve a single property. Because, after all, when we say that if the premises are true, the conclusion must be true, we're meaning different things. We're just equivocating. So we don't want to take. So this is already making us think that we should be worried. You should be worried if we really got two different notions of truth. But the worry increases when we think about something like this. Waterboarding is painful and waterboarding is wrong. Think about that proposition, the conjunctive proposition. Here we see the little Frege Geech monster coming back. Right? The little Frege Geech monster comes back. In what way is that conjunction true? Or what way does it represent? Is it expressive or non-expressively true? True in some third way, a mixed moral, non-moral way? There are various answers here. There's lots of answers in the literature. This is a problem that's gaining some attention. I won't bore you with those now. But just to register that this seems to be a problem. And one, in fact, I this is a bit of speculation, but in wondering why Simon had moved from what seemed to me a sort of truth pluralism to a deflationism, it seemed to me that this is the sort of thing that could easily have been what was motivating you. The sort of thought that, well, these problems just repeat the Frege Geech problems. And I take it that when you were talking about the fact that, you know, some of these sort of, the slow track tends to, you know, the train tends to grind to a halt, right, because of the roadblocks that are in front of it, that this is one of those roadblocks. And we can make notes here. I don't think that going disjunctive, saying that this is true in one sense or another, is going to help. We can talk about that more. There's lots of different things. Those of you who heard me talk last week at WriteFest know that I have more things to say about that. So what I want to just say now is that the upshot is that diversity has been gained, but unity is lost. And this last tactic. The first tactic, expressivism and minimalism, might gain us unity but loses us diversity, so I argue. This tactic might gain us diversity but loses us unity. Oh dear, what do we do? We need to make sense of the idea, it seems, that truth and related notions are both many and one if we want to get what expressivist wants. And as you can imagine, I have a suggestion. That suggestion begins with reflecting back on what we've learned and trying to think of those lessons and apply them in a new way. What does minimalism or deflationism teach us? Well, it teaches us an overall pragmatic strategy for defining semantic concepts. It tells us, look at the function of the truth concept. See what role that concept plays in the cognitive economy. Minimalism, in effect, teaches us that truth is a functional concept. You grasp the function, and you grasp the concept. It didn't come out. That's not supposed to be a box. Quantifier, X is true if and only if X has a property that plays the truth role. You can put it that way. I mean, that's in a sense what the minimalist is telling us. Look to the function, grasp the function, and you've grasped the concept. What is the function for the minimalist, though? Well, it's a very simple function. It's just a logical device. You grasp the function and therefore the concept if you grasp that logical device. Now, I've already suggested one reason for thinking that maybe the concept of truth is not a logical device. That is, for not taking that, for thinking that that's, there's something wrong with that, if you think that what I call represent isn't true across the board. If you take represent, the idea that something is true because, in some cases, because the belief state represents something, in part. If you take that seriously, then, I suggested, you're not going to just think that truth is a logical device. In any event, and whether you agree with me about that or not, it seems consistent with the basic idea that the deflationist has to look to the function, to think that once we look to that function, we'll see that there's actually more to it, that there's a host of interesting related concepts. I mean, after all, one of the things that functionalism and philosophy of mind has taught us is that when we look to clarify a functional role, we should look to see the relations that the target property or concept has to other properties and concepts in the area. And that we should see these concepts or properties as playing a part in a larger economy, a network. Well, how do we reveal this network to ourselves? Again, the minimalist and the deflationist tells us how. They tell us to look to the platitudes, the truisms, our folk understanding of truth. And they point to the T schema, or variations of it, as the central platitude. But the thought that I'm now entertaining, the proposal I'm now making, is that there are a number of different platitudes we might find useful in understanding and delineating the role of truth. And here are some. This is very much the attitude that Crispin Wright took towards understanding truth, both in his 1992 book, Truth and Objectivity, but in later works as well. We appeal to some of these folk platitudes, things like to assert is to present as true, the idea that truth is what makes beliefs, propositions correct to believe, that true beliefs are an aim of inquiry, and that beliefs are, some beliefs are true but not warranted, and some warranted but not true. These are the sorts of things philosophers of all stripes tend to want to think are right, or at least they think that many of them are right. Okay, so that's what minimalism teaches us. Tells us to look to the function. Suggestion, open up the scope of the function. That may help us. One of the things that it helps us is to realize that if the functional role of truth is to do is defined in this way, it's truth is a sort of thing that has a complex job. It's not merely a device for generalization. It's a little bit more complex. Then it's open, it seems, to find more than one thing that plays that role, that does that job. It's open to thinking that different properties can play the truth role in different domains of judgment. Functionalism gives us a way of identifying those properties as well. What properties are they? Those are the properties that play the truth role. So the idea is that I'm suggesting to the expressivist is to adopt the following picture. That there is one property of truth, the property that valid inferences preserve, that makes a judgment correct and a judgment we aim at in inquiry. It is a functional property defined by its role within a network of closely related properties. Now, of course, there's a lot of work to do to find out what that functional role consists in. There's a lot of work. To what extent are the normative platitudes, like I've been implicitly maintaining, actually distinct from the T schema? Perhaps they're really just descriptions about some other closely related concept like belief. I don't think that's the case. But you need to make an argument about that. There's a conceptual work to do here to find out exactly what all the truth is doing for us. How is it related to warrant exactly? But the thought is that once you get somewhat clear about the scope of this role, we can now start judging whether a particular property, like supercoherence, actually plays that role or not. getting clear then allows us to start making sense of our very project that we were engaged in earlier, project of supersizing coherence to see if it does something for us. What? Play the truth role for our ethical judgments. So the thought is that more than one property can realize or constrain or manifest truth. How much time? Should be wrapping up. Okay. All right. So I think what I'll do is I'll just wrap up. So the basic picture, what I've done, I hope, is to try to convince you that we don't, if we find the expressivist move an appealing one, and I do, then what we don't want to do is just adopt semantic minimalism, because its resources are too thin to allow us to make, to draw or sew the seams of language in a sort of bright enough way for us to do the work with them that we want to do the work that we want to do. And I've also tried to convince you that we don't want to just simply say that truth comes in many different kinds. What we want to try to do is look for a unifying story. And I've just gestured at what that unifying story might be. There's a lot more things to say about how to understand it. But in any event, if this view is right, then the door is open to holding that moral judgments are made true by a type of coherence, where judgments about the physical world are made true by representing objects in the natural world. And so, yet we can still say that expressive judgments are true in just the same way as any judgment. Why? Because they have the property that truth consists in, the functional property. In the same way that if we think that pain is functional, we think that the dog and the human can both be in pain. That they share something. So we think that expressivists, and that we can say something about what that is, by the way. So the expressivist, expressive judgments and non-expressive judgments can share something. So the thought that the view allows for, it seems, is the thought that we can have unity lay down with diversity. We can have Apollo cavort with Dionysus. Right. We can have truth as many in one. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. I can see a sea of hands already, so I'd like you to ask them, keep them up while I make a list. Lloyd, you start. Fully you reason from it, you still got to go and take a look, right?
something like that. I think this is a bit related.
Or at least that's a possibility of taking a month.
Yeah, well, I'm saying it seems to me that, and just to notice that in ethics and empirical matters, there's also this difference that it seems to me that a justified belief, right, this might want to point out, can be false. You can have, so that's why justified true belief is a problem, because it looks as though, whereas in practical matters, it doesn't seem to me you can distinguish between being justified in doing what you're doing and doing the right thing. I mean, I don't think you can get a gap there.
And that
puts both ethics and maths in the territory of the old-fashioned notion of truths of reason. And that gives you a kind of bifurcation. I'm not sure what to do about aesthetics, and I'm not sure what to do with the evaluative generally, because he's courageous and different.
Let me just respond to it. There's a lot there. Let me respond to it, just a few points. I mean, I think, strictly speaking, we can make a distinction in ethics, and we should make a distinction between an ethical judgment just being justified in the ordinary, everyday sense, that is, and it's, let's say, it's being coherent with the rest of my moral beliefs, and it's being true. This is why we need to supersize coherence. We need, if we're going to allow that some sort of epistemic notion is going to play the truth role in ethical judgments or any sort of for any sort of judgment, we're going to be able to. We need to make a distinction between that judgment being justified or presently coherent with my present beliefs and it being true. Because too many things too many belief systems that do hang together right now are crazy, and we shouldn't take seriously.
Example of an ethical judgment of right and wrong, which someone is fully justified in making, has given, you know, the best of reasons for it, and nevertheless, it's false.
Well, I mean, whether I can give you a successful answer depends on whether you and I share what we mean by best of reasons and fully justified. After all, if I thought that the proposition that I was going to give you was one that, let's say, you and I probably share most of our values, are fully justified, then it's not going to be one that I'm going to, or you're going to think, is false. Nonetheless, it still could turn out false, and the sad history of the human race indicates that lots of things that we thought we were fully justified in believing turned out to be wrong. So, nonetheless, your idea that there's a truth, there's something here between your first thought, that we who take some sort of pluralism about truth seriously are taking seriously the old distinction between truths of reason and truths of fact, is a good one, and it's something that I need to think more about.
Okay, my list at this point is Matthew, Jamin, Mark, Kevin, Patrick, Rachel, and now Mike. If there's anybody else who had their hand up that I didn't see, apologies. Put it up again now, please, and I'll put you on the list. But Matthew, you're next.
Okay, I like the talk. I wanted to ask about what I see as a sort of tension in the talk. And that's between your attitude towards truth and your attitude towards belief. Mm. So you're quite willing to go sort of functionalist, pluralist about different kinds of truth, but I wondered why we couldn't do that much earlier in the dialectic, go functional pluralist about different kinds of belief and explain the difference either in sort of the causal explanatory terms that Simon was appealing to earlier, or maybe in sort of inferentialist terms, which I've written about trying to distinguish sort of practical beliefs from theoretical beliefs. Why not do it there?
Right. Why go functional or pluralist about truth in this way, functional about truth and not about just belief?
I mean, it's really more of a priority question, because I think once you go in either case, you're going to end up with a functional pluralist view in the other case, but why do you start with truth?
Okay. That's the important point that I think, then that's sort of, that's a point of major agreement with us, because I think a lot of people think that you can sort of start with belief and fool around with that and keep truth sort of pure and virginal, right? And that is not going to work, in my view. These are, I didn't really argue for this, I just suggested it, but I have argued elsewhere that these are interdependent notions, and I don't think that's too shocking. Right? We understand what the difference between what beliefs and desires are, partly because of when we believe is to, you know, hold as true. So why, though, your question is the harder one. Well, then why is it that I think that, you know, we should start with truth? Well, partly because I think that truth sits in a little bit more centrally in the network. That the network of concepts that I was interested in are concepts like assertion, warrant, belief, we might throw in proposition, right? All these notions require truth for unpacking. And yeah, they might also, you know, to understand any of them, you might also have to bring in these other related notions. But truth tends to come in through the door. It's the first guest that arrives, it seems, all the time at the little party. And that's why I think that we need to start it there. I mean, I suppose, in my view, it's you know, truth is downtown with assertion, I suppose.
I want to give myself a finger at that point, saying, Mike, I think perhaps use your metaphor of the order in which the guests arrive. I think you've got a different way of running parties than I do, because I'm a sort of Humean expressivist. So the kind of guests who arrive first for me, I guests who are like Simon, so reflecting on things like the place, say, that probabilistic judgments play in our practical lives, the fact that they're linked up to our choices under uncertainty, or there are evaluative judgments are similarly linked up to our decision behavior. So it's those kind of practical facts associated with our use of our making judgments in particular areas, which are kind of foremost in our mind. They're the guests who are arriving first. And so that, I think, inclines us to think that the interesting diversity is a diversity about the practical role of what come to be seen as, but which are perhaps not initially, beliefs in a particular area. So that's a reason for putting diversity about the practical role of belief up front, rather than putting diversity about truth up front.
Or representation.
Yeah, or representation.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point. Let me just respond to that. Right, planning philosophical parties. Well, probably best not to have philosophers arrive first in general, but or somebody more or philosophical concepts, but something more fun. But point well taken. I mean, it certainly is the case that on my own view, as I've been extolling it here, there is a sense in which what I say about truth, if we're going to understand truth, we need to look at its function. So in that sense, I think you're right, that we do need to acknowledge that we need to look at what we do, our practices, and so forth. But it just so happens, and maybe it now becomes a matter of temperament, I think that we learn quite a bit by focusing on truth first. I mean, again, in part because it's the sort of thing that comes, you know, if you don't start talking about it up front, you're going to find that it's coming in through the back door. You're going to be making distinctions and kinds of representation, and then facing questions about, well, what does this tell us about truth?
Okay, so there are some big issues which we need to follow up, but let me go back to the queue. Jane, you're next.
I'm very sympathetic to much of what you have to say, but I think we draw very different lessons from creeping minimalism. Why you go one way or another rather than the other. So I take it you think that because of creeping minimalism, we should give up minimalism and adopt, you know, go slightly non-minimalist and adopt kind of pluralism.
Uh-huh.
I take the lesson to be that if you're interested in saving the differences in these kind of debates, semantic notions were never the place to start with in the beginning. So drawing it into any kind of semantic notion is not going to work. And that's what I take the lesson to be. So when I look back at your original inconsistent triad, but I see the problem there is that word represents showing up. Mm. And I say, let's replace that with a distinct metaphysical notion, like is made true by, or it's grounded in, or mm-hmm. depends upon. Mm. So I'm just curious why you go in another semantic direction rather than saying it's just the issue is never about representation in the first place.
Well, that's a hard question. But I suppose for much of what I said in the talk, you could translate represent for much, not everything. A lot of what I said, particularly my arguments about leaving, you know, why we want to leave minimalism, could be translated into, into the terms that you suggest. That is, that the contrast is about some sort of grounding issue. One of the reasons I favor represent is because I understand representation talk, I think, a little bit better than grounding talk. I mean, I went to Kit Fine's talk at the AAP and I wasn't quite sure still what grounding was. And some people might say, well, I don't understand what representation is either. And fair enough, right? You know, at some point, what do we understand anyway about these things? not much. but I do understand that there are projects in cognitive science that engage in trying to understand what representation is, and I think I understand at least some of those projects. And I sort of see them as at least on a continuum with some of the issues that philosophers have been concerned with representation. But of course, you know, you're right. You know, the first said that you know, this is the sort of thing you was touching on too. You know, well, why start with semantic concepts? Well, you know, maybe the thing to think about is that, you know, the guests that arrive, perhaps all, they don't really arrive one by one. They do arrive all at once. The very thing that, you know, Matthew was sort of talking about early on. Maybe that's just what we all need to say. Because certainly, we don't get started on the expressivist. We don't start down either the fast track or the slow track. Until we've sort of noticed that there is this difference in what we're doing. Now, what I wanted to emphasize is that we notice that difference in part because we're responding to something else that we've noticed, which is that there don't seem to be values littering the world. And we don't seem to think that we're tracking those values. That's what gets us started down the track, together with the thought that there is these other things that we are doing. Very important things: motivating, planning, cajoling each other, expressing our attitudes and our emotions.
Huh. I wanted to challenge you on how well your plurals about truth fits together with expressivism.
Yes.
So I don't think they fit together very well.
I suspected that.
Just like you're going to be a relativist about morality, you're going to have to be a relativist about truth. Expressivist, moral judgments, maybe some kind of expressivist about truth to get us to catch up. And so here's where I think the central word comes in. Suppose there is a property of truth in the world domain. It's one of these realizers, this general property of truth. Now let's step back and think, well, what's this project? Step back to the general ethical project and try to understand what judgments are about or what's going on with them in some sort of way. And if we got this property of moral truth that we can apply to these, whether it's some kind idealized acceptability or coherence, whatever it is, now I'll step backwards and say, hey, now that we have a non-expressivist story that we give about moral judgments in the first place, it's going to be when we say that stealing is wrong, that's really, you know, can be understood at least as this claim about the idealized acceptability of certain stealing is wrong, or the idealized acceptability of having certain idealized coherence, having a certain attitude towards stealing or something like that. Okay, and so when you start thinking, well, wait a minute, if we've got this property of the judgment that's saying stuff by spirit's truth, why wouldn't we be able to give a non-expressive story about the domain in the first place? That's the challenge. And I think Simon's actually gotten into a little bit of trouble for example, in understanding the judgment that I might be wrong about whether stealing is wrong, treating that as the same as I might under idealized conditions to give up my judgment and say this wrong. I think that's led him to a little bit of trouble. Mm. And so I think that the consistent way is, if you think there really can't be any answer to this question, what is the first thing that you're wrong?
Yeah.
And you shouldn't think there is any answer to the question, what is the first thing truly still is wrong?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the very same move that we need to express it about truth.
Yeah. Maybe. I think whether you're going to get into trouble in the way that you have laid out might hinge on how you understand what expressivism is, obviously, and what it sort of needs to be. And I know that you have a theory about this, and you'll be telling us more about this, right? But here's all I meant by expressivism. All I meant by the expressivist was the person who accepted some of those views that I laid out in the beginning, and also perhaps accepts the idea that what we're doing when we're engaging and making moral judgments is not expressing a representational state of mind. We're not doing that, right? Now, if that's what expressivism is, that's sort of, this is again, this sort of, I think it's, it is important to talk about representation in this sense, or in this case. You want to say that, well, we're not expressing a representational state of mind. That's what it seems to me we want to be able to say. The minimalist, as I was saying, has problems seeing how they can make the contrast in that way. I want to say, well, my view allows us to go back to that contrast. We can say that, okay, even if we want to say, if we want to call the things that we do express in our moral judgments beliefs, they're not representational. And that, you know, it seems to me we should be able to say that, we can say that, and still make sense of these things that we're expressing as being in relations of coherence to one another. That seems to be the thought.
Okay, I've got a couple of fingers on this point. The first one, Simon.
Yeah, just as a matter of biography, and I think that simplifies the point. But I moved away from the conception of ruling passions, as you rightly noticed, towards a more aggressive deflation, partly because I didn't eventually think that the conception of ruling passions actually gave us a conception of moral truth at all, even in your functional terms. Basically, because the sort of super assertability, as Chris would call it, had to be defined in terms of getting better or ideal or something. And that seemed to be not a satisfactory foundation point for a conception of moral truth. So I just want to say that. As
right. Let me, I mean, certainly I agree. I mean, one of the things I didn't do in this talk, but some of the slides I skipped by was, in fact, just addressing this question, which is a hard question. It would require, in fact, a whole talk or two or three or four on its own, is to try to get some detailed notion of coherence or supercoherence that allows for an understandable notion of improvement that doesn't get itself into some of the problems. And that's just going to be some hard work. Now, the question, you know, earlier, is that going to be dragging us back into metaphysics in the bad sense? I don't know. I don't know what the metaphysics in the bad sense is, or semantics in the bad sense. I don't think so. But you're right. We would have to do some work there. But I think that work can be done.
I don't think it can be.
Well, one thing I think that is important that, again, we don't have, I didn't put the view on the table, this view of what supercoherence is, so in a sense we're just talking about the abstract. But, you know, I do think I am sensitive to the idea that we better not just think of it as an idealized coherence. That's right. But indeed, this is one of the things that I think Crispin, for example, has been useful in trying to he's done a lot of interesting work trying to show us that we can have an epistemic notion of truth that doesn't involve, at least in one very important sense, a certain sort of idealization, but a sort of enduringness of warrant in the face of all future inquiry. And if that notion can be suitably unpacked and developed, which I think needs some, you know, we need to do a lot of work on that, then maybe we can answer these questions. But
just I mean, it does seem to me as though whether or not that direction is useful, it is antithetical to expressivism, as it seemed. If we work down to some substantial truth problems, the moral judgments are distinctly apt, in contrast with representational correspondence substantially understood in some way. That a particular moral judgment has that problem is something that I can colorably affirm.
Of course.
Yeah. I've not been characteristically expressing an attitude when I do that. Yeah. It's a matter of psychological contingency. Okay, there tends to be associated heat with such an affirmation.
Look, it depends again on what you think is characteristic of expressivism. What I thought was characteristic of it was the idea that what we're doing when we engage in moral judgments is not representing the world. We're doing something else.
But I can represent.
And I thought that this view just does make sense of that. Go ahead.
So,
Sorry.
Isn't there such a thing as representing in thought the fact that a certain moral judgment has that property?
Yeah, you
can. It seems like it's a real property. There should be such a thing.
Yeah, you should be able to represent that your moral judgments have that property. Yeah, you might be able to represent that. Of course, that sort of depends on whether your judgment's about... Now there's this question of whether when we make judgments about the sorts of properties that our judgments have, that is, when we engage in philosophical analysis, what sort of truth property, if any, is realizing the truth role for those sorts of judgments? But that's a different sort of thing. There's the judgment that murder is wrong, and then there's the judgment, what sort of property does that judgment have when it's true? Those are the two different judgments. And it may be that the one judgment is representational and the other isn't. That's open for investigation. In fact, it would seem to me that we wouldn't think that our analysis, our philosophical analysis, our philosophical discourse... I mean, I think it's a rather terrifying question once you start asking about what makes it true. Do our judgments about what makes our philosophical judgments true? That's a sort of terrifying question, if anything, because one does start to worry that maybe here we have lost even the domain of the expressive and it drifted into the realm of the comic, perhaps.
Back to the queue, I think. Kevin.
So here's a worry about the creeping minimalism argument. If you think about typical minimalists, think about a typical deflationist, like, say, Field, a disputationist, or Borges, a minimalist, not a Crispin minimalist, but the original minimalist, they don't take beliefs to be primary truth bearers. They don't take belief states to be primary truth bearers. Borges will take propositions, Field will take sentences.
Or utterances, yeah.
Yeah, but either way, not belief states.
Yep.
And so if the point that's supposed to be troubling to the deflationist or the minimalist is belief truth isn't purely expressive, I mean, it seems like the disputationalist on one hand or the Horridge minimalist on the other hand will say, yeah, so what? I mean, that belief truth is derivative. The important notion of truth, the expressive notion of truth, is propositional truth versus intentional truth. Belief truth is derivative. When I call belief true, what I really mean is the proposition expressed by that belief is true, or something like that. So that's just a worry about how you respond to that as a...
Well,
what would you say about that step, that in the creeping minimalism argument that gets the whole ball rolling?
Yeah, okay. Let me go back to that argument. Thanks for bringing that up. Okay. So, the argument here and on the last slide about belief, mind you, this one, was run, actually, with regard to propositional truth. The idea was, let's take propositional truth to be minimal, and then ask, can we draw the distinction between expressive and non-expressive discourses? Well, holding propositional truth to be minimal in terms of belief, argument, no, because that would entail that there are more propositions which are true, which we can't believe, or certainly don't believe. In fact, we don't believe any of them. In fact, one would think can't believe, because if expressive claims just are the ones that don't express beliefs, and in fact somehow can't, because that's not their job, in some sense of can't, then you get this weird result. So it was actually meant to be run in terms of propositional truth.
Can you run to the next slide? Sorry.
Sure. I just went to that one because you seem to be concerned with belief, so.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it represents, and that's the belief that P is true because...
Mm-hmm. Oh, so what you were worried here was that...
And then you go to the next one where you replace the belief that P is true with P.
Yeah, that's right. So I draw implications about minimalism there. So why am I not just concerned here about belief truth? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, now I understand. Well, that's a good question. I suppose what I'd want to say here is, well, this is how I was thinking about it. I was thinking about, well, you start with propositional truth, you're going minimalist about that, then you try to help yourself to a difference in terms of belief. That's not going to work. So then you sort of go minimal about belief too, right, which will give you a nice, easy way about being minimalist about belief truth. And then you try to run it in terms of representation. Now, I suppose you might say, well, that middle step, this is what you're saying, is somehow gratuitous. We don't really need that. And we really just are minimalist about propositional truth, let belief hang where it may, and it's what we make this move to represent. I still think you're going to have a problem, because even if you're still minimalist, if it's utterance truth or statement truth or propositional truth, you're still going to get, if you hold that, let's say, this thing, right, represent, is, suppose you say, well, this, you know, the sentence that, sentence, snow is white, is true because it represents that sentence, snow is being white and snow is white. Suppose you put it in terms of sentential truth. You're still going to get the bizarre consequence that you're not going to want to say that snow is white because the sentence snow is white represents snow as being white and snow is white. So you're still going to get the bizarre consequence, because it seems that in the very domain where you would want to say that represent holds, you don't want to say this, whether it's about sentential truth or belief truth or what have you.
Sorry, just one
okay.
Minute. The represents one with sentence instead of belief is exactly what the disputationalist will deny. Say, look, I've explained sentential truth completely by listing out the T sentences, and I'm done.
Yeah, well, that's fine, fair enough, but this is what sort of makes the position that I was entertaining, at this stage sort of bizarre. It's a position according to which you're trying to make sense that representation does some work, and yet you're already holding some sort of disquotationalist or minimalist across the board. So I take it what you're trying to say now is to say, well, however we understand the representational contrast, is this what you're saying, Kevin, that however we understand the representational contrast, so again, we're being minimalist or deflationist or disquotationalist across the board, take your pick. But we're still trying to say that some judgments represent and some don't, some sentences represent and some don't. You're now saying that however we're going to make that latter move, we better not make it in terms of this by saying that this doesn't hold in some domains and in others. Fair enough, but in a way, I suppose that's part of what I'm trying to say. And one of what I'm trying to say is, well, the reason, you know, once we see that, well, maybe a better way of putting it is a challenge. If you want to hold this position, I'm not sure anybody really does, but if you wanted to hold this position, you better have some way of articulating the difference between representative and non-representative discourses that doesn't have anything to do with truth, even in what looks to be at first a fairly innocent sense.
Patrick. Oh, Lionel, was that a finger on?
It was a finger. This
okay. Yeah.
This may be a way of getting at what Kevin was asking about. It seems like your move here presupposes that if I'm a deflationist, when I ask, why is the belief that snow is white true, I take myself to be asking, why is snow white? Now, there are deflationists for whom that would be the case, but notice that I phrased it, why is the belief that snow is white true? Now, if I ask, why is belief B true, which happens to be a belief that snow is white, it's not clear that I'm asking, why is snow white,
yeah,
even if I'm that kind of deflationist.
I don't see why I'm presupposing that at all. I'm perfectly happy for the deflationist, that is, just the deflationist, to, you know, just all on their own, to deny represent, as I was just saying to Kevin. That it seems to me that's what they should do. That's what I'm arguing. It seems to me that if you're a deflationist or a minimalist, you don't want to say something like represent. You don't. What I was suggesting, and what you should do at most, is say something like the belief that P is true if and only if it represents that P and P, where that's understood, you know, in a very, you know, in the way in which it sounds. And it doesn't require any sort of dependency relation. What I'm trying to make sense of is this idea, which I think, although seldom voiced, people seem to take seriously, that we can be minimalist across the board and yet say that there's some contrast in terms of representation. How else to do that except by trying to say something like this? That's what I'm saying. If you have, we have another way, fine. But I don't think I'm falling into that thought. Maybe what you're saying is, well, I would be if I'm forcing upon my imaginary opponent here this bad way of thinking about things. I'm not saying, well, I'm not forcing it upon them. I'm just exposing them as whole, as endorsing it.
Lionel, I think we'd better go back to the queue up because there's still several people on my list and we're running a bit short of time. So encourage everyone to be brief. Patrick, you're next.
Never mind, it's creeping minimalism. What about creeping functionalism?
Ah, yes.
So it seems to me if you're going to go for this role analysis of truth where you specify the functional role by a network of platitudes, as is seen by the different nature of different platitudes, they interconnect with other
indeed
notions. So what we seem to have is some kind of creeping towards some kind of holism. So there's assertion, belief, judgment, falsity, negation, proposition. Since you start to specify the network for truth, you've got this connection with this other rich set of concepts. Now, of course, creeping functionalism is going to be the idea that, oh, well, they'll have conceptual, they'll have functional roles too. If you put all those little networks together, you get a big conceptual picture. This reminds me of Strawson's later view on conceptual analysis, that all these notions are equibasic, though all the platitudes are equal, but perhaps some are more equal than others, so you've got something a little bit more downtown than the rest. Okay, but the idea is, well, what is it then to grasp the concept of truth? You might say, oh, well, it's just to grasp a sufficient number of the platitudes explicitly involving the notion of truth. But imagine if I've got loads of false beliefs about what assertion is, and judgment is, and belief is, and somehow these are all interconnected. So it seems to me very puzzling to know what it is to grasp the concept of truth on this creeping functionalist picture, because someone like Strawson, I think, would be tempted to say, well, to grasp the concept of truth is to grasp a huge number of these claims within the network, rather than just the ones that explicitly involve truth. So I'd like to know what you think about that.
Well, it is sort of a creeping functionalism, except I wouldn't want to say that it's creeping. It's more like marching boldly forward functionalism. The creeping makes it sound like it's sort of lurking around in the bushes, waiting to pounce. To your question, I'd say this. I think anybody who thinks that concepts are, defined by their relations to other concepts is, of course, embracing some sort of holism. But it seems to me that you can make distinctions between the sorts of relations that are core, shall we say, and those that aren't. I do think that it's hard to draw that distinction, but something like this might work for present purposes. So it seems to me that with regard to truth, there are certain core truisms, that I call them, that are all actually defeasible. They're not, you can give them up, even the core ones. You just can't give all those, the ones that are core, because you can't deny all of them, or even most of them, at the same time and still be understood by your fellow human beings as talking about the same thing. You might be able to deny one of them, and even if you deny one of the ones, another feature of core process, so that's one feature of core, what makes certain platitudes part of the core for a given concept, is you can't deny any all of the ones in the core without being taken to be talking past your other fellow human beings who are employing that concept. The second thing that's a feature of the core truisms or platitudes is that if you deny even one of them in the core, you've got to have some important story to tell about why we were attracted to that one in the first place. So think of Hume on causation. There are various things that you, of course, accepted, things that he thought that an ordinary person believed on causation. One of the things that he thought the ordinary person believed was that there was, or at least certain philosophers believed it, maybe not ordinary people, but certain philosophers, is the necessary connection between cause and effect. He denied that. But he felt compelled, because he denied it, to try to give some story about why we were attracted to believe it in the first place. On my way of thinking about it, that's because that sort of truism is core. It holds a sort of status in our mastery of the concept. So I do think there is at least two things that we can say about what separates core truisms from other truisms. Yes, there's a network, but they come in little clusters. What delineates the clusters are these little features that I'm talking about now.
Rachel.
So you said that the disjunctivist pluralist proposal you briefly gestured at.
I don't think so, no.
I wanted to sort of propose a way that you might make it work.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So be a disjunctivist about some kind of basic or atomic sentences. And then, so truth for purely descriptive sentences is one thing. Truth for purely normative sentences is another thing. And then recursively define truth for mixed sentences. Mm. So what it is for P or Q to be true is for either P to be true on sort of previously defined truth conceptions or Q to be true and so forth. So that seems like it gets you around the obvious problems with mixed sentences. You're still going to have worries about, you know, P is possibly true. Mm. But that seems like a route to go if you're attracted to this type of question.
Yeah. Indeed, perhaps not surprisingly, I'm attracted to such a position myself for functionalism as well, because the issue of, without getting into the issues of whether, I mean, it's sort of, at this point, it really depends whether that's going to work out, that proposal, is for any given type of truth pluralism, it's going to depend much more on the details of that pluralism than I really gave here, because there's a lot of different variations of these views. And all of them would be well served, I think, by trying to at least initially take seriously the sort of thought that you were sketching. And so in this book that just came out, it's not surprising that from my own view, I run something similar to that. It's not quite a recursive strategy, though, because I don't think we need to go full recursion, which of course requires, you know, lots of machinery to try to get us to take seriously the idea that conditionals actually sort of can fit that machinery, right? You know, the machinery has to be really elaborate to take us full recursion all the way across the board, take that really seriously. We can actually just do, I think we can, the truth pluralist of any stripe can probably help themselves to a, or most stripes anyway, to a weaker proposal. Namely that we do apply the theory first and foremost to atomics, and then just say that the compounds, however compoundy they are, their truth, as it were, supervenes on the values of the atomics, right? And you can put that's pretty much, much weaker. And of course it has problems too, but it's meant to be in the same spirit.
Mike, you have the last word.
Yeah, this is vague. It's just an invitation to elaborate a little bit. But going back to your, I think it was the final slide. So, in the moral case, if you do go down to supercoherence,
right,
the moral truth, you've got a nice internal connection between truth and justification. Truth just is idealized justification. On the other side, where truth is representation, if you wanted to preserve an analogous internal connection, I suppose the natural way to go would be for some kind of radical externalism about knowledge and justification, where that's also explained in sort of tracking or broadly representation as notions. A, which seems deeply implausible to me as an account of how we justify things even in physics.
Right.
But B, which seems to, at least in a vague way for me, raise the unity issue all over again. In other words, if the two types of truth then turn out to drag the epistemology around with them.
Which so I think they will.
I mean, it starts to look as if we've got, you know, we can identify the action that consists that plays the goal scoring role in Aussie rules, and we can identify the action that plays the goal scoring role in association football, but there's no interesting game that actually involves doing those two things at once. you know, in other words, I'm worried about diversity hardening into bifurcation because of the tendency for fundamental truth.
Because the structure of justification.
Idealistic within
right.
Its domain.
Now, that's a really good worry to have. I see the point. I do think, so there's a lot there. A quick comment. It's going to be the case, if you're a functionalist, that what is in common, of course, is, I mean, this is why the view is a variety of deflationism, in a sense, right? Which I believe was the one, something you said many years ago when you first heard me talk about this, was, isn't this just a variety of deflationism? I guess, in a sense, I'm sort of saying, well, in a sense, yes. I mean, it has a certain spirit. So there is this, the unity is going to be rather abstract. But one of the things that's going to be unified, and in my view, is it's. I think that probably what you're going to find is, with regard to epistemology, is that you're going to find that, well, and this is, of course, a theoretical commitment of mine, that something doesn't play the justification role unless it's truth conducive. Now, in the case, you're right, in the case of moral judgment, the truth conducivity is sort of guaranteed to an internal connection. Which I think is a good thing in that case, because in the moral case, I think it's harder for us to take seriously the analog of global skepticism of the radical sort. That is at least Cartesian skepticism. Regress skepticism, different issue. But it's harder to take that seriously in this case, in my own view. In the case of perceptual judgments and judgments about the objects that clutter our everyday life, then I'm at least willing to take more seriously the skeptical alternative, even at least initially, even if, you know, I'm open to having my initial serious take on skepticism undermined by some sort of therapeutic story that talks me out of it. But I do think that there is that difference, but I don't think that is bizarre, unfortunate, just maps the fact that there is serious differences between these types of judgments.
Okay, thank you. We're out of time, so let's thank Mike for a we started it at 2:15. Now the lunch options, there are really lots of them. If you just walk out here.